It's official. Alabama is about to have a Democratic senator.
The certification was completed at 1:10 p.m. this afternoon.
Our White House correspondent reviews his first year covering the Trump era.
This is like nothing I have ever encountered before.
And Congress left itself plenty to do in the new year.
A lot of Republicans, including House Speaker Paul Ryan, have said, well, this doesn't need to be addressed until March, so what's the hurry?
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. For those of us who cover Congress daily, we'll see some new faces in the new year. Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith will be sworn in as that state's newest senator, appointed to the seat after the resignation of Democrat Al Franken. And for the first time in a quarter century, the Democratic cloakroom off the Senate floor will welcome a senator from Alabama. Doug Jones's special election win on December 12th was certified this week by the state's top officials.
The certification was completed at 1:10 p.m. this afternoon.
It'll mean a smaller Senate majority for Republicans, 51 GOP senators and 49 senators who caucus with the Democrats. That race got a lot of attention from the political press corps and continued to up until its certification. Republican Roy Moore filed a last-ditch challenge to hold off on making the result official, even asking for a new election, claiming voter fraud and intimidation. The state Secretary of State says there's been no evidence of that, and a judge quickly dismissed the court filing. President Trump weighed in on the race this week, too, telling the New York Times he endorsed Moore only because he felt he needed to as head of the Republican Party, noting he originally supported Luther Strange in the GOP primary. Jones's victory was the first and only seat flip of a congressional race in 2017. Despite President Trump's tweets last week that Republicans were 5-0, Republicans did win five special elections in House seats across the country, in each holding on to a seat previously occupied by a Republican. But Democrats held on to one of their own seats in a special election as well in California after Democrat Javier Becerra stepped down to become that state's attorney general. So at least in congressional races, the House and the Senate, Republicans won five special elections. Democrats won two for a net gain of one seat for Democrats. What it all means for November's midterm is obviously hard to predict. Democrats are feeling optimistic after winning a lot of down ballot races, picking up state legislature seats in districts won by President Trump, and won governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia. But the RNC continues outpacing the DNC in fundraising. The RNC reported raising $121 million in 2017. The DNC, by comparison, collected a little more than $60 million this year. It's cash both parties hope will be spent to elect even more new faces when the 116th Congress convenes in January 2019. The second session of the 115th Congress will gavel in next week with an agenda that is largely made up of things left incomplete this year. Rachel Sutherland chatted about what got done and what will be next year's knockdown, drag-out fights with our senior Capitol Hill producer, Chad Pergram.
So Congress is on recess. They're gone. They've gone to home. Where do they go when they're not here?
Well, a lot of lawmakers get off the grid. You know, Congress gets beat up a lot. They do take these big recesses in August, but there is always work to be done. They like to appear in their districts. They're always making sure that they're visible, delivering turkeys at Christmas time, ringing bells with the Salvation Army, conducting Congress on Your Corner events, even during the holidays, because, you know, they're in Washington a lot. And when they go back to the district, it's important for them to be seen, just not for the sake of being seen, but also say, look, you know, we have to be in touch with our voters, because when you stop doing that, then they're not, and people forget who they are, and they don't understand the general concerns. So that is something that they are definitely doing during these respites. But there is something special about the holidays, and that is why members were really, trying to push to get out of here as quickly as possible. punted a lot of these big items until January because they don't get a lot of time with their friends and family.
Right. And I was wondering that, too, because some people, when I chat with folks, they say, well, where are these members of Congress? They work so little and they get paid so well. But I have pointed out a lot of them, they maintain homes in their districts and businesses sometimes, too, right?
Right. Right. Absolutely. And that's one of the other issues, too, is that, you know, members of Congress, they are well compensated. But they're flying back and forth all the time. They're going on trips overseas to check in with our troops, or if they serve on, say, the foreign affairs or foreign relations committees, they need to go and meet with foreign leaders and understand, you know, what's going on in Europe, what's going on in Africa, what's going on in Asia, what's going on in the Middle East, visiting troops in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. So, you know, they're always on the run. And the other thing is that it's all, just because Congress isn't in session doesn't mean things aren't getting done. And the public often sends kind of a mixed message. They say, why aren't you guys in Washington getting things done? And then they say, well, why aren't you back here in touch with our people? So they send these cross messages. And for the members of Congress, speaking frankly, it is very hard for them to win.
Yeah, well, yeah, but they're between a rock and a hard place and low approval ratings, too. But it reminds me, when you mentioned money, didn't Jason Chaffetz actually cite that as a reason he needed to leave Congress?
Well, you know, you talk about people with, you know, three or four, you know, kids. You talk about maintaining residences in both places, in Washington, D.C. and back home. There was something that I asked House Speaker Paul Ryan not long before the recess about. He has always made a point of sleeping in his office. I don't recall that we've had a Speaker of the House sleep in their office.
Congressman Sanford did at one point.
There's a lot of them who do. There's a Jason Chaffetz certainly did. You certainly wouldn't catch the former House Speaker, now the Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, sleeping in her office.
I can't picture Nancy Pelosi sleeping on a cot in her office somehow.
Right, right. And the reason I asked the question, for years now this has been argued that it's a benefit that members of Congress are getting. They don't, you know, those who don't get an apartment or don't buy a house in Washington, D.C., why should they get this federal benefit of basically a free apartment to sleep in their office and they shower in the House gym and so on? The reason that this issue has matured a little more now, and the reason I asked the question of House Speaker Paul Ryan, is you have a lot of members sleeping in their offices. You have all these sexual harassment questions on Capitol Hill. You have staff working in the office late at night. The member over in the other office, you know, snoring or walking down in their skivvies over to the House gym.
Yeah.
That's a problem. Now Ryan got a little defensive when I asked him about this. He said, well, he said, we do it for convenience. He said, you know, we don't really do it to save money, although a lot of members of Congress will say that because that looks good back home. Well, I'm not going Washington. I'm not going local. I'm not going native. I'm not even going to buy a place. I'm going to just sleep in my office. And all the new freshmen, when they come in, all the local news crews come in with them and say, oh, look, he's going to even sleep, really rough it and sleep in his office. But now in the context of sexual harassment, people are wondering, and that's why I thought it was a very important question, to get the Speaker of the House, who sleeps in his office, on the record. And he defended the practice.
That's really interesting that you should bring that up, because I'm getting this visual of people in footy pajamas just walking around the hallways of Congress. A security guard doesn't know a lot of secrets, I imagine.
Absolutely. And reporters who are there late at night, too. We won't address what reporters are late at night at the Capitol working, keeping track of these guys. We do keep some pretty late hours on Capitol.
I know it. And you did it in particular over the end of the session when they were trying to wrap up the tax bill. They were trying to fund the government, and they got stuff done, but then they put off a lot. When are they coming back?
Well, they will come back in kind of two waves. January 3rd is the constitutional day that they have to come back. The second session of the Congress will begin. And the Senate is going to be a little bit ahead in terms of the House. The main reason the Senate's going to start, they have some nominations and some things that they have to deal with. But the two big things that's going to happen in the Senate on January 3rd is they're going to swear in Doug Jones, the Democratic Senator-elect from Alabama, who defeated Roy Moore. The Senate breakdown is going to flip from 52 to 48 Democrats who caucus, or 48 Democratic senators who caucus. There's two independents, Bernie Sanders and Angus King, and it will be 51-49. That's going to be a narrow, narrow edge. You know, Vice President Pence has broken a lot of ties on Capitol Hill. Vice President Biden never did have to break a tie in his entire 8 years, and Pence has broken several already. So that shows you how narrow this is going to be. They will also swear in Tina Smith, the lieutenant governor of Minnesota, who will succeed Al Franken,
right.
who resigned considering amid this sexual harassment scandal we're talking about.
Interesting. Yeah, you mentioned that narrowing of the margin there. I guess we'll see more of those tie-breaking votes, and it'll get that much more difficult for Republicans just to be able to really get anything done.
Well, and it's just not the Republicans. It's getting things done that they have to do. Republicans are very excited, obviously, to get tax reform done. It was a big achievement for them, whether you like the bill or not. We'll know in a couple of years whether it's a good bill or not. These things take a while to play out. But what they did not accomplish was a longer-term plan to keep the government funded, government operations. Just January 19th is when they have to go back at this. They have to renew FISA, which deals with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, domestic spying, which is very controversial. You have civil libertarians on both sides of the aisle who don't like this. They say,
right.
We shouldn't be involved in this. They have to figure out a disaster spending bill. They approved an $81 billion package in the House of Representatives for Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, wildfires in California, also Texas, Louisiana, and Florida.
Why didn't it get out of the Senate?
Because they didn't like the bill. It's unoffset spending. This is the third tranche of money for disaster relief. Previously, they had already approved $52 billion. I talked to the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosello, who was at the Capitol right after the House passed the bill pretty overwhelmingly, and he was willing to hold out hope. He said, we want a better bill. And I said to him, wait a minute, you know, on Capitol Hill, sometimes you don't get anything done. You want if that's the best you can do, you take a half loaf. And we realize how dire the situation is in Puerto Rico, but he thought that there could be a better bill. John Cornyn, the Republican senator from Texas, who's also the whip, he suggested as much as well. So the Senate will take that bill that the House approved. We're still in the same Congress here, so they can do this. And they will amend it and probably have to send it back to the House of Representatives. The only question is, it's not done. So you never, if something's not done, it's not done. And you never know if it will get done until it really is done. Number two, it's a delay in the amount of time that these communities in Puerto Rico, in the U.S. Virgin Islands, in Texas, in Florida, I still need this money to help rebuild, and it just puts it off a little longer.
It's been a really tough year for disasters. Well, when looking at DACA, let's go to that real quick. What do you see as the prospects for that, and do you see Democrats trying to attach that to the spending bill like they tried to before?
They absolutely could try, but we'll see where this goes. Now, the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, in the Senate, indicated that he will devote floor time, his words, to working on DACA sometime in January. A lot of Republicans, including House Speaker Paul Ryan, have said, well, this doesn't need to be addressed until March, so what's the hurry? Democrats, some in particular, like Luis Gutierrez, who's a Democrat from Illinois, very outspoken on this issue, they were upset at the Democratic leadership that they did not force the hand, saying, you know, they can't pass a bill to keep the government open at Christmas time unless they use our help, meaning they didn't have the votes on the Republican side of the aisle. And so they said, all right, if you can't pass a bill on your own, even though you're in the majority, come to us. We'll help you with those things, but it will come at a price.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, the Democratic leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, and the Democratic leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi, elected not to go down that road. Now, it's generally thought that they will have more leverage in January because you get closer to this deadline. The government is funded through the 19th of January. The president is supposed to come to Capitol Hill on the 30th of January for his State of the Union message.
Right.
So you can start to, and you're in an election year.
Yes.
So you start to see where
already.
This leverage might work out a little more. But I was struck by how many protesters were at the Capitol in the office buildings late at night, mm-hmm. they're not allowed to be in the office buildings on Capitol Hill, protesting in the Senate office building, the Hart Senate office building of Chuck Schumer, 8 o'clock on a Friday night, lots of arrests, Tim Kaine from Virginia, a few others. And they're protesting the Democrats because they didn't think that they went to the mat for them on the DACA issue.
Is that why Nancy Pelosi then went before the House Rules Committee and spent, 2.5 hours there? I was a little surprised to see her do that.
Right. The House Rules Committee is the gateway to the House floor for most pieces of legislation. They had a very lengthy meeting the last day that they were in session before the recess. It's very rare to see one of the party leaders or the speaker or someone of that caliber come to the Rules Committee. And she testified for about 2.5 hours, as you say, making the case. Now, this is internal Democratic politics that Nancy Pelosi is involved in. She obviously wants a DACA fix. She wants it sooner rather than later. She also knows there's probably more leverage in January and down the road for the Democrats, but she had to put up a fight and put up a good optic that I'm here before the Rules Committee making that case. You know, I haven't forgotten about you. There's a reason why she was there at 8 o'clock in the morning for this Rules Committee meeting.
I watched the whole thing. Anything else they left on the table that needs to be done?
Well, you know, one of the things that looms out there, and we'll see how this goes, are CSRs, cost sharing reductions. This deals with health care. President Trump cut those payments off to lower income persons in October. And this is a key component of Obamacare. There was some legal wrangling in the courts, which basically ruled in favor of the House of Representatives, said, well, you know, that you're paying out this money, but it hasn't been appropriated. So that violates the Constitution. So why, you know, Congress is ultimately under Article 1, Section 7. You know, they call the shots when it comes to spending. And if you haven't appropriated that money, why is the administration paying this? Obviously, the Obama administration was much more willing to pay that than the Trump administration. The problem is that Republicans see this as saying, wait a minute, we can't leave these people on the hook. We don't like Obamacare, but we have to do something about this. And that's why there is a bipartisan plan crafted by two senators, Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who is the chair of the Senate Health Committee and the top Democrat on that panel, Patty Murray of Washington State. Alexander Murray is the term you're going to be hearing. And we thought that could be enrolled maybe into that interim government spending bill right before Christmas. It could come up again. It's something that was a key reason as to why they got Susan Collins, the Republican senator from Maine, to vote for the tax bill, saying, OK, if you put that in there, you know, I'll vote, you know, down the road. That has to be part of the understanding. That issue is not being greeted very well by Republicans in the House of Representatives. There appears to be support to do it in the Senate, but not in the House.
Hmm.
And this is where one side or the other is either going to completely lose on this or eat what the other body passes if they put that in there.
There's a lot going on, and I appreciate you joining me. And when we come back in the new year, maybe I'll head on over at night to see who's running around in their skivvies, as you say.
Absolutely. Come on over.
All right. Thanks, Chad.
Thank you.
The White House press corps has been put through its paces this year, some of them accused of being fake news and failing to report what one advisor once called alternative facts. Our guy at the White House, John Decker, has had a first-hand account of all of it, interacting daily with the president and senior staff. We talked about his first year of covering the Trump administration and whether he thinks the media has been too harsh on this president.
It's been almost a full year, John Decker, of you covering this White House, the Trump administration. What's your initial takeaway? This is what, the fourth president you've covered?
This is the fourth administration, the 12th press secretary that I've worked with, and this is like nothing I have ever encountered before. Every day, there's something new, it seems. And it seems as if this president has, and his team, have ripped up protocol. They really don't care what the former administrations have done. They want to do things their way.
Well, that certainly speaks to how the press has covered this administration. I guess we start from the first day, or maybe it was the second day, when Sean Spicer, the first press secretary for President Trump, gathered all of you pretty late into the evening and had a few words to say about how the inauguration had been covered. Take us back, if you can, almost a year ago.
This was January the 21st, a day after the president was sworn in. I happened to be the pool reporter for radio on that particular day, so I was here at the White House. It was a Saturday. We began the day by traveling to the National Cathedral for a prayer service. Then we went to the CIA headquarters, where the president gave an address to CIA officers. And we came back to the White House not really expecting much else happening on the agenda when we were summoned to the briefing room. And Sean Spicer, the first White House press secretary, meets us in the briefing room. And he proceeded over the course of about 20 minutes to berate everybody seated in the briefing room for our coverage of the inauguration. He claimed that the president was shortchanged in terms of the amount of individuals that came out to witness the inauguration in person, and he said that this was an example of fake news. There's that term that we heard quite a bit during the first year. And in addition, he really went after one of our White House colleagues, a reporter by the name of Zeke Miller, who at the time worked for Time Magazine, who erroneously reported that the president had removed from the Oval Office the bust of Martin Luther King Jr. incorrect. The bus was never removed. It remains in there to this very day. So Sean Spicer, getting some walking orders from the president to go after the press, and that's what he did his second day on the job.
So you mentioned the pool report that Zeke had filed. He had apologized, explained how that mistake happened. Those things occur, and that's fine. But let's get to the brunt of what Sean talked about that day, which was a demonstrably untrue statement about the number of people at the inauguration. It had been well documented that fewer people attended President Trump's inauguration than had attended the first inaugural for President Obama. And that was sort of expected. So what sort of path did that lead you down with how it was going to be covering this administration versus previous administrations?
Well, it was going to be different. And I believe that Sean Spicer got off on the wrong foot with the press corps because of that first appearance that he made in the White House briefing room. You have to be truthful. That's one of the first sort of rules of thumb for a White House press secretary. And Sean Spicer on that particular day was not being honest with himself, and he wasn't being honest with the reporters that were in the White House covering the president on his second day in office. So we saw a lot of that over the course of this first year in office. Kellyanne Conway also saying things sometimes that were not true and were proven to be false. That being said, this White House is not embarrassed sometimes saying things that ultimately can be shown to be not the truth by the press corps, by some of those facts like PolitiFact and other sites that challenge the record being put forward by this president. That's something that we did not encounter at all during the Obama years or the years of George W. Bush or Bill Clinton before him.
Let's talk about sort of that comparison. You and I actually our seats were next to each other for a time in the briefing room during the Obama administration. We were in those briefings together. No administration likes the way, in most cases, that they're covered by the media. There's always going to be some pushback. That relationship is always going to be adversarial to a certain extent. The administration is always going to present the facts or the spin that puts them in the best light, and there's going to be fact checks, and they're going to have to respond to that. That's not new, but what you're describing in the Trump administration is a little bit different than the formula that had played out in past presidencies.
That's right. It's a different formula. It's a formula in which from the very start, the mainstream press corps was seen as the enemy. They were described as such by the president, both publicly on Twitter, by the people that speak on behalf of the president. And this is something that obviously plays to the president's base, which has stuck with him from the very start, has not seen anything wrong for the most part with anything the president has done his first year in office. And you didn't see this that much during President Obama's time in office. They saw some value in reaching out and trying to establish relations with the press corps. This administration, it seems at times as if they see no value in trying to reach out and establish good relations with the press corps.
You know, that's an interesting point, too, because this president has done fewer formal press conferences than his predecessors. But at the same time, there is an awful lot of access to this president. He speaks off the cuff, I think, far more than President Obama did in these Oval Office encounters when he is walking from the Oval Office or the residence to Marine One on the South Lawn of the White House. Has that been your view that while he doesn't do a lot of, President Trump doesn't do as many sort of formal interviews or formal news conferences, did not do a year-ender, for instance, which had been something that we had seen from the last several administrations, he has made himself accessible, maybe even at times where his own staff has maybe preferred a different strategy.
Right, but this is one of the great things about this president, so different than President Obama or President George W. Bush or Clinton before him. This president does take questions. He answers your questions. You may not like the answers, but he answers your questions, whether it's in the Oval Office or the Roosevelt Room, the Cabinet Room, as you mentioned, on the South Lawn of the White House. And the president had one, count it, one formal press conference back in February during the course of his first year in office. There's still some time left, of course, between now and January 20th, but I don't anticipate another formal event like the one we saw last February. That being said, the president, when he signs legislation, he'll take questions from the press corps. When he's meeting with his counterparts from around the world, he'll take, as is typical, questions from the press corps. And when he's meeting with congressional leaders, sometimes in the Roosevelt room and the cabinet room, he'll also take questions from the press corps. So this has been one of the bright episodes, I think, that we've seen over the course of the president's first year in office, his willingness to answer questions from the press corps on a variety of topics, including topics that, you know, he may be uncomfortable with, including that investigation by special counsel Robert Mueller into alleged ties between his campaign and Russian officials.
President Trump has done quite a few availabilities with some friendlier outlets. Some of the opinion hosts on the Fox News Channel, for instance, has not done as many with I guess, what he would describe as the mainstream media. That being said, how many sit-downs interviews has he done with the New York Times? He did one this week in Mar-a-Lago, and people may wonder, you know, he's pretty critical of the New York Times, calls them the failing New York Times, always throws them in the mix when he's complaining about fake news. Does he have a soft spot for his hometown newspaper?
Yeah, this is his hometown newspaper. This is the paper that he grew up with. So he does have a soft spot for the New York Times. He sees it as the paper of record. He's aware of that. That's the reason why over the course of his first year in office, he's done a handful of sit-down interviews with the New York Times, with Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, Glenn Thrush as well, sometimes joining them. And, you know, look, this is, I believe, the reason why the president does these interviews, not because he wants to give value or worth to the New York Times, which he's often called failing. It's because he realizes that his hometown reads that newspaper on a regular basis, and he wants to get his message out to his hometown newspaper.
What challenges has this administration presented to you as a reporter? Is the way that you ask questions in the briefing room had to change? Is the way that you've presented your radio stories to our audience had to change, given sort of the new rules of the road, so to speak, the way that this administration has handled the way that it puts information out there?
Well, I cover this administration just like I covered the Obama and George W. Bush and Clinton administrations, the same way, asked the same hard questions. I think the big difference, though, Jared, is the fact that the news cycle changes so frequently. You know, you'd have a news cycle that would last 24 hours under President Obama. It can last just an hour under President Donald J. Trump. And the reason being is because he could just tweet something out, which forces the news media to change the direction in terms of what they're covering on that particular day. He tweets in the morning, early in the morning. That can change what the focus will be for any particular day. And so because this president uses Twitter in that fashion, it's changed the way not only Fox, but every news organization covers this presidency. And because of that, it's changed the length of the news cycle, which sometimes is very, very short.
I don't want you to grade your colleagues. I don't want to put you in that position. But I will ask it this way. Do you think that this president has been given a fair shake by the White House press corps?
I think that there are some news organizations that view this administration as one which is an adversary, straight up an adversary. And it's quite clear if you flip on some of those 24-hour cable channels, that is their focus. That is what they want to do, and that appeals to their audience. And they've, you know, figured out that this is something that works for them. Cable ratings are up at all three cable networks, Fox, CNN, and MSNBC. Fox continues to lead the pack. That being said, there are times when I do, and I'm not sympathetic, you know, to the president. He's a big boy. He can handle himself, and same thing with his team. But there are times when I think, boy, the president can't win one with the group that sometimes covers him.
Get some rest, John. Going to be a busy 2018 for you.
Busy, busy, busy. You too, Jared. Have a good one.
That will do it from the From Washington podcast for this week.
And this year, President Trump and Republican leaders in Congress are expected to spend the first weekend of 2018 at Camp David to plot out the legislative agenda, an agenda that will be slightly more challenging with an even narrower GOP advantage in the Senate. Congress will also only have a couple of weeks to again meet a funding deadline that threatens a government shutdown. If you haven't already, you can subscribe to this and all of our Fox News radio podcasts, including the Fox News Rundown, delivered every morning to your phone. And as always, stay up on the very latest with your Fox News radio affiliate and our social media pages on Twitter and Facebook. For all of us at Fox News Radio, Happy New Year. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.